Welcome to Stupid Not Stupid. I'm Matt, here with my man Jason, the co-host who turns every record to gold that he touches.
That is correct. That is factual.
Not counterfactual. That, you know, that's actually a good point and worth pointing out as a reminder for our audience. The intro music, whatever it is that folks just listen to because you don't record it after, you have a custom song for every episode, which is like a little bit of work and I guess qualifies you as an artist.
Yeah, it's the minimum amount of work.
To be considered an artist or just the minimum amount of work?
Just the minimum amount of work.
In general.
Yeah, so, you know, those intros, I think we have to keep the intro music to like 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. And the actual custom part that I do usually winds up being about 15 or 20 seconds of that, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter. It usually takes me about an hour and a half to record.
Well, keep it up, someone listening like cares about the music.
Right.
So
right.
Yeah, it's an art form, Jason.
Yeah. At this point, like we've discussed maybe just
recycling,
stopping doing that and just like coming up with a generic theme or something. And, like, I just can't do it.
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. If that's the single one of your addictions that you're going to hang on to, I'm supportive of that.
Well, honestly, you do all of the other work on this podcast, so I feel like if I don't do that, I'm just really not contributing.
You're the beauty. You'll be on our if we ever get like an album cover or something, we'll put your face on it so it sells.
Yeah, the title of that album will be Faces for Radio.
Yeah. Well, the other tradition we have obviously is drinks. What do you got this week, Jason?
Well, you know, it's been a really long time since we did one of these, so I went with some really original stuff.
Okay.
I've got a Flying Dog Raging Bitch. and I'm drinking I think a bottle that we haven't touched since the last episode, which is some Angel's Envy. Right?
Do we have that in the last episode?
It's been
all
so
right.
Long I have no
yeah.
recollection.
All right, well, yeah, I've got the Angel's Envy too, and then I've got a 8-point American IPA, which I think got left over here in the beer fridge on poker night. And I'm gonna give I think this is the right person. I'm going to give a shout out to a new member of our poker game, Chad Merica. And Chad, I'll send you this episode for your official shout out. I think you left this here because literally his last name is Merica.
Oh, right.
So I think he got the 8-point America IPA. So thanks for this, Chad. And thanks.
That would track.
Chad was also the guy, I don't know if you remember this, who brought over like the $400 bottles of scotch. And then they
were all empty.
Both of them were like empty at the end of the night. And I felt so terrible when I walked out here and saw the bottles sitting on the floor. So double thanks to you, Chad.
Yes.
All right. So this week's, this month's episode, actually, we didn't talk about this before, so I don't know if you know this, but the other reason besides the fact that we're just like behind on getting an episode out that I wanted to do this one this week is Frank Drake died.
Oh, that's right.
Last week. He's 92. Frank Drake, a fame of our second episode.
Yes.
I think that's how he really got on the map was when we did that episode.
Exactly, yeah. Nobody knew who he was until that episode.
Before we got involved. But two things that are sad. First, that episode, hard to listen to when you go back to the show in its infancy, but also sad that Dr. Frank Drake is no longer with us. And of course, a fame of the Drake equation.
Yeah. No, he was an eminent scientist, and that was definitely his sort of popular culture claim to fame, but I think he was quite an astronomer aside from that. Sorry to hear that he passed, but 92 is a pretty good run.
Yeah. And so it sounds like we're both in agreement that Frank Drake is not stupid.
Yes.
So that's clearly not the topic of this episode. But
that's right.
I think the topic of this week's episode is one that I think we both agree is cool, and so we knew enough about it that we could kind of do it off the cuff. But I don't know if we have a definitive answer on if this topic is stupid or not. What we're talking about is the golden record, and the golden record, not the Midas touch of Jason on whatever musical work that he's marinating on at any given time, but the golden record as it applies to the Voyager spacecraft.
Yes. Yeah. So this is, it's one of the things about the space program outside of astronauts that is actually fairly well known. Mm-hmm. And it dates back to the 70s, which is pretty cool because... Yeah, I'm a big fan of the 70s, but
so let's do this. Let's say briefly what the record is. We don't need to go over the content that's on it, Jason. We'll save that for when we get into the real question here. But why don't you tell us very quickly what the record is? We'll get the context of the mission it was attached to, and then we'll start to go through. Obviously, I have a list of counterfactuals and loosely supported and barely defensible ideas around why I think one position is superior to the other in terms of stupid, not stupid.
Right. And I'll tell you why you're completely wrong.
Exactly.
And give you actual evidence and information.
Okay. See, you remember how this goes. what is the golden record briefly, Jason?
The golden record was an actual album made of gold that was attached to, there were two of them made. Well, there were more than two of them made, but there were two that were made and sent into space aboard the Voyager 1 and 2 spacecraft that were launched in, I think, 1976?
Seven.
Okay, 1977. So the concept of the mission had been around for since the 60s. There was a grad student who had figured out as part of his PhD thesis or his master's thesis out at JPL that, or at Caltech. He was doing this work at JPL.
Yeah, Gary Flandreau.
Right. So this kid figured out that...
And he really was a kid.
Yeah.
Too,
yeah,
like, was, I mean, not in
he was not,
yeah,
like, he was, 11.
He wasn't, right. Yeah. Yeah, he didn't do this with his Legos, but...
Yeah,
I mean,
this wasn't a Doogie Howser episode.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right?
He was younger than us, though, so he's a kid to us.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
So he figured out that there was this very, very rare alignment of orbits of the outer planets of our solar system that was going to happen in the 70s that would allow a spacecraft to use gravity assist by flying past each of these planets, that it could visit all of the outer planets.
In one run.
In one run.
One straight shot.
And this happened...
And it cut off 20 years, I think, on what it would take then to get something from Earth to Neptune.
Right.
At the time.
At the time. Just the rockets that were available, the what we had technologically available at the time.
Well, gravity assist wasn't really a huge thing then. Either, because there's another grad student just before him that his work is based on, who I read about, Michael Minovich, and he was kind of at the cutting edge of figuring out, well, if you come at a planet, well, there's not really a front or a back of a planet, right? But there's the direction the planet is going in terms of its orbit around the sun. If you come at something from behind it, you can speed up. If you come at something from front of it, as in the direction, if it's coming towards you, you can slow yourself down. This is called the three object problem. Or there's a term for this in physics, but basically it was so complicated in terms of the variables involved that it couldn't be solved until there were computers.
Right.
Like, it took an algorithm to solve this out. But these guys, basically, Flandreau, who discovers the alignment, he does it while he's studying the work of this other guy, Malkovich, who's figuring out which direction we need to come to which planet from in order to make this alignment work.
Right.
Or take advantage of the alignment.
Correct. And so the outer planet science community thought this was a fantastic idea and immediately proposed a mission, and they, you know, thought they were going to go with this. But of course, the nature of space science being what it is, figuring this out in the late 60s and putting together a mission by 1977 is a staggeringly fast time to put together a mission and try to build the coalitions that are required to spend that kind of money on a science mission. And they weren't really able to do it. So at the very last minute, by last minute, I mean, if it takes 6 or 7 years to put together a space mission, in the early 1970s, they were able to convince NASA to put, basically a bunch of people at NASA realized that this was literally a once in a lifetime, probably a once
it's like
in
every
several generations.
140 years, I think you get the chance.
Yeah. So they decided that this was not an opportunity they could pass up, but they couldn't do the grand tour because it was going to be way too expensive. So what they came up with was sort of an offshoot of the old Mariner spacecraft, and they put two of these things together because they realized by the time that they were going to be able to launch them, you weren't going to be able to get all four of the outer planets, not including Pluto. So this is all four of the gas giants in the outer solar system. They weren't going to be able to get one spacecraft to go to both of them. But what you could do is launch one that would get two, possibly three of the planets, and the other one that could get the other two planets. And so that's what the Voyager missions became. And
I saw they did it for like $360 million, which is, we won't even get into the aside of the space mission that you and I just went and visited over the week. But that is like probably what they did to roll out Artemis onto the launch pad, right?
Right. Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people will, you know, say, you know, look how cheaply we were able to do that in 1977. And those things are actually still flying, which is true, and still sending back information, which is also true. But what, you know, the instruments that they took out there by today's standards were extremely primitive. I mean, it was the first time we'd ever sent anything out there. So that data still holds for several of those planets. We haven't sent anything else out past that or out to that, to those destinations since. So that information is still really good. Nevertheless, what they were compared to most of the spacecraft we launched today, it's comparing apples and oranges. So don't get too hung up on the cost.
Yep. It's comparing spacecraft and newer spacecraft.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So those are the like kind of like parent craft for the disc, right?
But that's correct.
So that's really what we're talking about is the golden record. Call it a disc? Is it? I guess it technically is disc in shape.
Well, it's disc in shape. I always think of discs though as like frisbees that would have like a lip.
I mean, that's not the aerodynamics of the. They didn't just like throw it out in
space.
Right.
No, they did not.
And it just kept going forever.
Right. No, they attach it to the side of the spacecraft. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, getting something attached to a spacecraft that is not engineering or science necessary, mm-hmm. you would not believe how complicated that is.
Well, and the bureaucracy involved in it. So
that's exactly right.
That brings us to what the record. Yeah. Actually is.
Oh, and by the way, it wasn't just the record that they had to attach. They also had to attach a stylus.
Yeah, the ability. So, and we can get to that too. But So there was a gentleman who you and I are familiar with, Mr. Carl Sagan, who essentially...
That's Dr.
Carl Sagan. I'm sorry, Dr. billions and billions of Carl Sagans.
Well, we throw around, you know, PhDs willy-nilly
on the
show.
Well, yeah, we just give them away. So why should I respect people who actually go out and get them? But Dr. Sagan came to NASA, a professor at the University of Cornell and a well-known and celebrated science communicator.
Yes.
Came to NASA and basically pitched this idea. And there's some, I guess, room for conjecture here on whether this is considered a time capsule or a form of communication to another species that may have in the future encounter the Voyager spacecraft. But basically pitched them on this concept of including a data dump. Of all of humanity, an explanation, a roadmap, a 101 guidebook to what humanity is, where we are, and what we're all about, and putting it on the spacecraft in the form of a golden disc.
Which at the time was the height of high fidelity sound systems.
Mm-hmm.
Just as a very quick aside, just because I love this story, Carl Sagan's papers ended up at the Smithsonian just a few years ago. And I knew one of the curators there who had been going through the papers, and they had found a letter from Johnny Carson, the old TV show mm-hmm. host, to Carl Sagan. And the letter, it was so good because you had mentioned, you know, Carl Sagan being famous for saying billions and billions. Mm-hmm. Well, it turns out he didn't actually say that.
I know.
Right. Yeah. So Johnny Carson wrote him this letter, and it was just two sentences, and it was fantastic. It said, "I understand, or dear Carl, I understand that you never actually said billions and billions. You should have, Johnny."
Well, speaking of things that Carl Sagan said, thought, or did, a lot of them made them on to this record that is apparently the physical embodiment of humanity's ambassadorship to the universe.
Well, he proposed the record and then also basically led the...
He chaired the committee responsible for determining the content we were going to put on this basically time capsule or encyclopedia of humanity that would be launched out into the solar system with the, I guess, belief... hope in, I guess, in the event that it encountered intelligent life at some point on its journey.
Yeah. Now, Carl,
that's the general idea behind it. You would agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
And Carl was kind of well known for this in that community at the time. Mm-hmm. He was also responsible for making the cameras on the Viking landers
mm-hmm.
mobile,
right.
movable, because he was concerned that, you know, there could be a green alien standing just off frame, waving that we couldn't see.
And, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, too, but it's Voyager also that he has turn around and take the pale blue dot photo. Is that Voyager? I think it is.
I think it is Voyager. As a matter of fact, I know that it's Voyager.
If it's one or two.
I don't remember if he was the one that had it turned to take the picture, but
he
was the one who coined the term pale blue
dot. In Journey to Space by Bruce...
Murray.
He talks about this.
Yeah.
And I read it. So yeah, no, that was definitely
okay.
Sagan.
I couldn't remember that particular detail, but I do know he was responsible for
it. Hey, Jason,
term.
I just quoted a book.
You were doing your own research.
I was doing my own research. So look, this is the concept behind the record. We can talk really quick. These are some of the things that made it on. So the first thing that you would get, and we'll talk about how you extract this information in a minute.
Yeah.
But the first thing that was placed on the record is a greeting from the UN Secretary General at the time. So we'll just play his greeting really quick, and you all can get a sense, because I think this is important for the subsequent information that we're going to see on here. As we begin to have a conversation, if the contents of what was added to this record, what it was working to communicate, and if the things we were communicating were a good idea or, in fact, stupid.
Right.
Some things we shouldn't be communicating out into the universe. So here's the opening salvo of the Golden Record.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.
And I'm going to let it play for a second longer, and I think just for the sake of a future argument I'm going to make, these are the greetings that follow immediately after the end of the Secretary General's comments.
Silema chemen. Oiknes poteste chairete. Eirenikos prosphilos elelithamen philoi.
Paz e felicidade a todos.
Gotwai homa. Zuk gotwai. Ping on gin hong fai lo.
Adanish lushulmu.
Здравствуйте, приветствую вас.
สวัสดีค่ะสหายนายธรณีพลพวกเราในธรณีนี้ขอส่งมิตรจิตมาถึงท่านทุกคน
تحياتنا للأصدقاء في النجوم يا ليت يجمعنا الزمان
and that goes on and on. So we'll parking lot that and come back to it. But some of the other content that made it on were sounds of the earth. So the wind, thunder, different animal calls. There's also a collection of photographs that made it on. I think it's like 165 photographs that were curated by the committee and made it on. Also some just like general greetings and sounds of humans, like laughter, footsteps, much of which was Sagan himself or his children.
Yes.
He was a pretty good dictator in terms of determining the content.
Yes.
That made it onto the record. After your own heart here, Jason, an array of musical selections.
Yes.
I kind of lost count. You can pull this thing up on YouTube and listen to the whole thing and look at the images and stuff. But the number of like musical selections on there is staggering.
So
over like time frame and style and culture.
Yeah, this is one of the famous jokes when this album was launched aboard the spacecraft. You know, there were all these questions about, you know, what happens if somebody receives it. And you know, the joke was that you finally get this message back from an intergalactic civilization, and the only thing that they send, the only message that they transmit to the Earth is send more Chuck Berry. Yeah.
A couple other things that made it on, about an hour long recording of brainwaves of Anne Druin, who would go on to become Sagan's wife. I don't know if they're married at this time.
I think they were.
But it's her thinking about the history of Earth.
Right.
So she's reading things or thinking about things or expressing in her mind like what it feels like to fall in love, or recounting the history of Earth by reading it and then measuring her brainwaves.
In case the aliens are telepathic, apparently.
Yeah.
Right.
So that made it on. And then a pulsar map that would allow, if you were an alien and you did find the disc, allow you to trace your way back to Earth.
Yep, a map home.
A map home, and a pretty clear, in terms of mathematical language, equation for pointing to the speed of a hydrogen proton going around an atom, a hydrogen being the most common element on the periodic table.
Right.
So assuming that if the aliens that we encounter are familiar with anything, they're familiar with hydrogen. So measuring the speed
also
of
the most basic element.
The most basic element. So you use that as a baseline to say, determine all of the other kind of mathematical language that you find on the disk. The base point for it is the speed of a proton around a hydrogen nucleus.
Right.
And so that comes into play when we get to the stylus.
We're using the term basic in the scientific sense, not the current popular.
Yeah, hydrogen's so basic, isn't it? I mean, right? So that brings us to the stylus, which has, it literally is what it sounds like, right? Like this is how it plays like a record player, right, Jason?
That's right. Yeah, it's a diamond tip needle that you put onto the grooves into this golden disc, and that's what creates the sound.
Yep.
Through vibration, and then it had instructions on how
engraved on the disc. Yeah. So the instructions for how to play it are engraved on the disc, and there's a stylus on the spacecraft, and the hydrogen atom is used as the baseline to say this is the speed at which you should, not at the speed of the atom, but you can extrapolate out from the diagrams that are there, the number of rotations per correlating rotations of a proton around a hydrogen nucleus that you need to turn the record in order to unleash the information that's on it.
So I suspect we're going to have a number of references to the movie Contact here, which was based on a book called Contact that was written by Carl Sagan. In that movie, in that book, this entire concept was sort of fleshed out. This idea of using the hydrogen atom as the first common reference point to build a language that you could communicate with somebody who had none of your cultural touch points, had none of your background, probably had none of your physiological traits. So it was like it was trying to break communication down to the most basic form.
It's the same with like prime numbers is another thing that people get for this.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So that's enough context, I think, about like what the concept of the record is, the kinds of things that were on it, and why supposedly it was a good idea.
Right.
So now let's ask ourselves the question, Jason, stupid or not stupid, we should have made this thing and we should have sent it out into the universe. So I think we agree that it's cool, right?
Like
it's an interesting, cool science thing that happened in its very 70s. And I mean, it's neat.
It's one of those low probability, high impact type of events, right? Like it didn't, in the scope of things, it didn't cost very much to do. And the probability that another civilization will ever find it or be able to use it is extraordinarily low, but if they did, the impact could be tremendously high.
Yeah, right? I mean, tell that to the other billions of sperm that you and I beat out to be here today, Jason. So, just saying, man.
That's right.
All right. So, what I'll do now, typical stupid, not stupid fashion, I'm just going to go through a number of issues that I see with the record that could potentially open the door to stamping it forever stupid in the eyes of the future generations that will look back over the smoldering ruins of humanity.
As they live under the slavery of the alien overlords.
Exactly.
Right, yeah.
Exactly. So the first issue that I have with the Golden Record is, if you go back and look at the history of it, and we talked a little bit about Sagan and his committee and some of the things that made it on, I mean, at what point did it stop being a science experiment and start being, or a scientific endeavor and start being a vanity project? So like a third of the stuff on there is like Sagan himself, like Sagan's heartbeat, Sagan's laughter, Sagan's footprints, the voice of Sagan's son, the brainwaves of Sagan's girlfriend.
Right.
Like, how was he like, I don't have as much experience with like scientific committees as you do, Jason, but how often does the chairman just dictate down all the things that are going to be in like, I don't know, the decadal survey or whatever the committee's putting out, right?
So I think it's a direct correlation. Like the amount that the chairperson is able to dictate is inversely correlated with the importance of the information.
This felt to me like reading about the formation of the Golden Disc felt to me kind of like that's the recent search for the new Jeopardy host, where at the end the guy in charge of the search just puts his hands up and goes, obviously I'm the most qualified. All of my research has led me to believe that I am the perfect ambassador going forward.
Well, and I think Carl Sagan's argument was it didn't matter what kids were laughing or what brainwaves you used, because they were just supposed to be indicative of humanity. Mm-hmm. So why spend a bunch of money trying to figure that out when he had people right around his house that he could just record? And I think I think the rest of the committee basically was like, yeah, this is ridiculous and we don't care. That's fine.
So that gets to my next problem, like with the record itself, that's still kind of part of this first overall point I want to make. And that gets to the greetings and the languages and the variation and all the different messages that we put on it. So we hear the opening message from the Secretary General and then immediately go into 50 straight languages alternating, basically like saying, hello, welcome, we're your friends. Like, how confusing is that going to be for like the language scientists of the alien civilization to obviously hear this like opening salvo, 45 seconds of dialogue that is obviously the most important thing, because it's first on the record, that they would assume is the base kind of data set you need to decode the rest of the language on the disc? And then all of a sudden,
already going to be having trouble with that accent.
With that accent, right? Yeah. And then all of a sudden, we just go into like 50 other languages immediately after in tiny snippets and confuse the whole situation. Made me think of the movie Arrival that we've talked about before.
Yes.
Imagine like they figure out the first circle with the little lines on it, and all of a sudden then they start writing triangles.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they immediately switch to the Japanese or Spanish of their language. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's kind of the first problem that I have with it. The next is this oversaturation of music. Like, for some reason, humanity chose to put like one third of all of the information they wish to relay to you is like related to music. I guess like maybe we overdid that connotation because it was on a disc. But what conclusions is another civilization or species going to draw by the fact that we literally dedicated that much bandwidth of the one message we have to send just to music? What role are they going to think or assume that music plays in our society?
Well, first of all, it does play that much of a role in my life. But I think that the point was trying to show the diversity of humanity, right? The diversity of cultures, the diversity of input. I totally understand what you're saying that, you know, why did you pick music over painted art, or did you pick it over literature, or, you know, scientific papers, or, you know, war stories for that matter. I think the point was just trying to show the diversity of experience and show that there were so many different types of music that these many cultures had created. But I agree with you. Like, it doesn't do a great job of explaining this is one of many, many expressions that these cultures are developing.
So you raise another good point there, that it doesn't do a good job of over demonstrates the diversity and doesn't do a good job of relaying a coherent message. And then this gets, so this ties back to kind of my original point with this first point, in that it, so much of it is connected to Carl Sagan himself,
right,
and came from Sagan. So if you're an alien decoding this and you read the brainwaves and Carl Sagan keeps popping up there, and then you measure the voice and Carl Sagan keeps popping up there, and you have some way to determine then, oh, that child's voice, that's connected to Carl. Like, so much of this is Carl Sagan. If I was decoding it, I'm either going to assume Carl Sagan is the god of Earth,
right,
and we're all trying to communicate, tell you how great Carl Sagan is, or like Carl Sagan, like, was the last one left. Like, he's the last man on Earth, and he's like calling out to the universe. Right. Like, we communicated a exaggerated focus on one individual when we're trying to speak out to the universe as a civilization.
Oh, I agree. And I think that Carl Sagan was probably thinking in terms of, this will be great. If they try to contact us, they'll think it's me that they need to contact.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
But in fact, if they're deciding that they want to conquer Earth, they could be thinking, that's the one we need to kill first, right?
Okay, so I don't know if we need to make a ruling on it yet, but exactly, the one we need to kill first, I think that's the segue into my second point and why I'm really worried about this disc, right?
The map home.
Yeah, the map home. So we put this pulsar map on there, which is basically a guide on how to get back to Earth. So let's assume that an advanced civilization does find this, and let's also assume the lowest common denominator, I guess, that they're not super friendly. Like, just by nature, are destructive or warlike, hostile civilization.
We have nothing like that on this planet.
Yeah. So we've given them not only a map of how to find us, but on the disc we provided the atmospheric conditions on Earth, anatomical charts of humans, all kinds of, basically everything you would need to figure out how to kill us. Or like how vulnerable we are. Like, when you think about the Independence Day movie, like the first 2/3 of that movie, like they're trying to figure out, like, can we kill the aliens? What is their anatomy? Like, how do we get, like, all of this stuff, like understanding the basic anatomy of your opponent is a key to being able to destroy them. And we basically gave them a schematic on how to destroy humanity and a map on how to get there.
Yeah, but you don't necessarily need that information. I'm once again reminded of the Futurama quote that we've used before about the aliens who come down and threaten to increase the temperature of the planet by 1 million degrees per hour until they get what they want, right? The other great quote here, of course, the perfect encapsulation of your concern here comes from the quote from the movie Contact, where James Woods' character, you know, says they first receive the message from this alien intellect, and they're like, this could be, you know, the cure for cancer. And he goes, yeah, or, you know, could be, you know, explaining how they expect us to behave while they invade, right?
Yeah.
You know?
Right. So I guess I've been laying out a lot of the problems I see. So Jason, I don't know how you feel about this one. Like, you are the king of pessimism and assuming the worst. Was this, at least portion of this, I won't ask you to make a ruling yet, stupid, not stupid, on the golden record, but a map to Earth, including, you know, the makeup of our atmosphere, the things upon which we are dependent, a diagram of DNA, our entire reproductive system, a map of our entire anatomy. Should we be advertising that in terms of first contact? Maybe build a little trust before we share some of this stuff? Like, you know, take me to dinner before?
Right, right.
I mean,
well, this might be a good place to get into some of my issues with all of these concepts. The extreme low likelihood that this disc actually does anything. Just some back of the napkin distance concepts here, right? Like, we tend to talk about astronomical distances.
AUs.
Either in terms of AUs or in terms of light years.
So, and an AU, just to be clear, is the distance between Earth and the sun.
That's correct.
So we use that as a baseline to measure distance
to
in
go
space.
From the sun to Earth is one AU.
Right.
The entirety of our solar system out to the very last planet is about 40 AUs. The Voyager spacecraft currently is at a little under 150 AUs, mm-hmm. right? And it is the furthest thing that we have ever sent from Earth out into space by a large margin. Mm-hmm. It's just been in the past couple of years that it has left the heliosheath, mm-hmm. meaning that it is the first thing to have exited our solar system. So that's 150 AUs. The nearest star to our sun is Proxima Centauri, which is about 4.3 light years away, as mm-hmm. I recall. So one light year is about 65,000 AUs. Mm-hmm. So we're talking several hundred thousand AUs. And the thing that has taken this spacecraft 40 years to achieve is not even a percentage of that distance.
Yep.
So it will be tens of thousands, more likely hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of years before this thing gets anywhere of any interest.
So lucky for you, I looked this up.
Right.
So it's not headed towards Proxima Centauri, which is about 4 light years away, which is the closest.
Right.
But the next solar system it will encounter, and it will get about 1 light year away from the sun in this solar system.
Right.
It'll be there in about 40,000 years.
Right.
So you're thinking best case scenario round trip for a species that can't get it, understand it, and assume that they're advanced enough and in this one single solar system to get here, traveling at the speed of light to come back.
Right.
I mean, best case scenario, like what, 50,000? I mean, around 40,000 years, probably closer to 80,000 years if they have similar technology and want to send something back.
Just for the sake of argument, let's assume that they have some technology that's so far beyond our understanding.
Yeah, so 40,000 years.
Right. And just for the sake of argument, we assume that it's 40,000 years. Yep. That's so, basically the entirety of modern human civilization.
No, it's way more. So if you go back to
of modern humans, not civilization.
Yeah, yeah. So if you go back to our pre-human civilization episode, I went back and double-checked. So just the blip of time that civilization has existed that we've looked at, which is between 3,000 and 5,000 years, depending on how you define civilization.
I would even go 10 just for the sake of argument.
It's still 0.04% of the existence of the universe. So we're talking about the amount of time that humans have existed as a tangible and consistent entity. That amount of time would quadruple before we're even thinking about this happening.
That's exactly right. Yeah. So the chances of us actually being a species that's recognizable by the information on that album, not real high. The chances of us surviving as a civilization, non-existent.
So this kind of got to the one piece of evidence where I was like, maybe the record isn't stupid because it's more of a time capsule than it is a message in a bottle.
Right.
In that by the time anything finds it and reacts to it, it doesn't fucking matter anyway, because we will either be so advanced or so long gone.
Yeah.
That it doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's why even that is in its own way maybe a little stupid, but it's less mm-hmm. stupid than giving people a map to our planet and all the information that they need to destroy
us. Which you sounds like that you agree that that part is stupid because as we've said before, we can't take for granted some other kind of crazy technological leap or the capabilities of another civilization. That look, they might be out just skirting the. Maybe they have a prime directive that you don't enter the heliosphere of another solar system in which we've detected life, but then they come across the Voyager and they're right there. And there are things we can't conceive of, and we've provided them.
Maybe
the map.
Something really strange happened on their planet, and the color gold is evil.
Right?
Who knows?
Okay. All right. So that's the worst case scenario in terms of they're hostile. But now let's think what if they're like you and me, Jason? What if they're just science loving hippies that just want everybody to get along?
Oh,
right?
No. I'm on the hostile side of this.
They don't want to go full Independence Day locusts and move from planet to planet, consuming the resources.
If some platinum album shows up from some other universe or some other galaxy, rather, with instructions on how to get there and how to infiltrate their life and destroy their planet and take over, I'm 100% on board with that.
So let's say they find it and they don't want to destroy us. But the other problem is if they find it, they're definitely going to fucking come, right? Oh, yeah.
Well, they're going to try and communicate first somehow.
Right. In some way, we will interact with them and they're we are going to make contact if they discover this and they have the ability to want to contact us, right? So, I mean, one, they're going to want to come because it's scientifically relevant, right? It's interesting and scientifically relevant. It might even be first contact for them as well, right? This might be the defining moment of their particular civilization.
Which I think is actually likely.
But they're also going to want to come because Mr. Sagan again. Dr. Sagan was pretty intentional in the information that was included on this disc, and it wasn't just information that was focused on aggrandizing him, but it also makes Earth look like a pretty desirable place. It was a conscious decision of the committee to not include images of disease, famine, war, poverty, ideology, or religion,
right?
Which are all defining characteristics.
Like, I don't know
how do you talk about humanity without, how do you leave one of those out?
No, those are the defining characteristics of humanity.
So to someone who's like looking at this and you see this like highlight reel of stuff that we've sent them, like, how do you not think like Earth is the Garden of Eden, right? How do you not think it's a paradise? Like, it's obviously this amazing utopian civilization that's defeated war, erased poverty and famine, and found a way to live in harmony. We need to go there and learn from them.
Exactly. And somewhere out there, there's a Captain Kirk who's thinking he's definitely getting laid on that planet, right?
So they're definitely coming, which we designed the disc in a way that I think is stupid to make them think that this is a place you definitely got to check out. So even if they have the best of intentions, and we've definitely given them this motivation to come.
See, I would posit one other possibility, though. If something like that showed up in our,
you would think it's a trap immediately, right?
I definitely would. Like, there's no way that you have that kind of diversity without having had some kind of animosity, right?
Wouldn't it be intriguing to you, though? Wouldn't you be like, because that's your instinct and because that's your experience, wouldn't it be even more intriguing to you that it looked like they'd figured it out?
No, I would think we definitely need to see what's going on here, but bring guns.
My point is they're going to want to see what's going on here.
Right.
So even if they're the best intentioned aliens that the universe has ever cooked up, and they just want to check it out and see what's going on, and they want to come examine the utopia.
They are Dr. Sagan's idealized aliens. And they come for scientific
curiosity. To worship at the altar of Sagan. Like, they're just coming to meet the Sagan god. I mean, if history has shown us anything on our own, I mean, how many more people did European missionaries kill than they converted in terms of disease? I mean,
my next point was backwards planetary protection.
Right, backwards. So give us real quick, like, the coolest job description at NASA is the planetary protection officer. Like,
that's
what
correct.
Is the con? We've talked about it before on the show, but like in 30 seconds, like,
his name is Dr. Nick Benardini.
Yeah. So just really quick, Jason, what is the concept of planetary protection, and why are we all going to die even if the aliens are super nice and come to visit
us? So planetary protection is the idea of protecting Earth's ecosphere and other planets' ecospheres or atmospheres from potential biological contamination. And there are forward and backward planetary protection protocols. The forward planetary protection is so that we don't send microbes from Earth to another planet
and specifically infect it.
Hopefully, particularly not to infect it, but particularly to planets that have the ability or the potential to harbor life. What you really don't want to do is go and discover life for the first time in the solar system and then find out that maybe it was contamination
you brought it with you.
Because that just muddies the waters terribly.
Yeah.
But the other side of this is backwards planetary protection. So, for instance, we're talking about bringing samples back from Mars in the year 2033. There are unbelievable efforts being planned right now for recovering those samples and keeping them contained so that in the very, very, very unlikely event there's any biological material that is extant, meaning in existence now, that it can't interact with the biosphere and become something dangerous. And what we're talking about with this idea of the aliens coming and being very benign and wanting to meet us and shake hands with us, well, we don't know if they wash their hands.
Right. I mean, what was like 98% of Native American populations were just like wiped out within a generation of contact with Europeans. Like, what do you think is going to happen to our species?
Right.
Like, it's the same Petri dish. It's just a different experiment.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Whatever the biomes may be on their planet, whatever the biohazardous materials are that they would bring, none of us would have any immunity to that because we've never been exposed to it. You know, the Europeans had grown immunity to that stuff because of their very specific, you know, cultural and locational experience. The Native Americans had never been exposed to any of that, and that's why they were so susceptible to it. Well, our entire planet would be in that position.
Right.
Right.
Okay, so disease is one. Let's say they're still peaceful and they don't bring disease. Let's say they are smart enough or experienced enough because they've done this before to send down like a robot first or something, or just hover above the planet and communicate.
A sexy, sexy robot. Right?
Yeah, that is the personification of Carl Sagan, right? They send like a model that they think will be the most pleasing to us because it is it in the form of our God.
Billions and billions.
But let's say they're not aggressive, but we can't discount the aggression from our side.
That's
right? Like, how do we know Trump's not in his fifth term when the aliens arrive and just immediately launches missiles? Or let's say that, you know, we don't have like a crazy tyrannical despot in the White House that can keep their finger off the nuclear button, but we can't control North Korea. Like, we don't have a global civilization or government. We don't have a species that acts as one, right? How do we stop one act of aggression from pick your nation state from triggering conflict with the aliens when they arrive for all of us?
It doesn't have to be a nation state either, right? Like,
right.
This is an unprecedented encounter. It's going to generate a lot of fear with a certain percentage of the population. Yeah. And some of those people are going to be in positions of military power or in, you know, missile silo somewhere. Like, you can't predict that stuff.
And so this gets to the next point. So you think about heads of state and potential acts of aggression, but then the destabilizing kind of influence this is going to have from like a religious perspective. And we have lots of theocracy. Well, not lots, but we have enough theocracy, some of which with nuclear capability on this planet.
Right.
You know, what does this mean for the structures of society, specifically the structures of our society, like with huge overlaps with different religious beliefs? And what does this mean for those? And how much motivation will the power structures connected to those religious beliefs have in maintaining their, I guess, legitimacy over the belief structure that they proliferate by destroying the thing that might disprove it?
Right. So I'm going to throw a counterpoint to you at that. What if we had sent a bunch of information about the various religions on Earth?
Oh, shit.
It also is just a roadmap for them to be able to co-opt them.
Here I am. Yeah. Or to emulate them.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. How much of the Bible did we put on the golden disc? And he's like, here I am. I am Yahweh.
The second coming. Yeah.
That's a great idea. Dude, if we get a platinum disc from another soul, that's the first thing I'm doing.
Is becoming the alien deity. Yeah.
Yeah. That's like the greatest Kaiser Soze moment of all time. Okay, that's brilliant. Okay, that just proves my point even more. I didn't even think of that. Jesus, that's like dark, but kind of funny at the same time.
That's my whole thing, man.
And then, you know, also just like thinking about just broadly, let's say that the disease thing doesn't happen. We don't launch missiles at them. They're totally peaceful. But then the societal breakdown itself that will be caused by it. Let's say they do park, you know, on the other side of the moon and just like beam radio signals at us. But then the impact of that just, I'll say like domestically, I don't know what the term is for like domestically on the planet.
Sure.
But I'll just say like
globally.
Globally, like it just causes so much chaos and we just like behave like so adolescently that they're just like, okay, we're not interested anymore.
Sure.
We're good.
Yeah.
Thanks for playing. Like, let us know if Sagan's available later. Like, the rest of you see.
Worst rest area ever.
Yeah. Right. Right. Are they even going to be interested in communicating with us?
Well, and the thing is, I don't think that radio communications necessarily would cause that kind of breakdown. But what I'm concerned by would be the idea of if they come to us, they are almost inherently
more advanced.
Going to be more advanced. Yeah. So the technology transfer is going to be ugly. Either they give us nothing, in which case you'll have people that are going to demand attacks on them to go like capture their shit, or they'll have things like, what if they have some way to do alchemy? Like you can actually turn lead to gold. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden the price of gold collapses on the planet and economies go into disarray. Right.
What if they think gold is the most important thing to us because we sent them a golden record.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Or what if they are able to cure cancer, but we have to build the technology? Well, then all of a sudden you have this rich versus poor dynamic.
Or what if cancer makes them immortal and they just beam like radiation down on us? You're welcome, like peasants. Here you go. Live forever, right?
Yeah, like Iridium wanted to when they were talking about charging cell phones from orbit. All of these things are possible. I remember Michael Crichton had a book called Sphere years and years ago that there were a lot of discussions about the concept of a culture so alien to us that we just didn't understand anything, like, and how dangerous that could be. One of my favorite lines was, Yeah, what if the sound of their voice just liquefied bone structures? Like, the numbers of what if are just infinite. So it's hard to imagine.
They speak in the brown note. Whoa, oh, my God. Oh, I cracked my pants.
That's amazing. I told you guys. Dude.
Right, yeah, exactly. There's no possible way to predict what that outcome would be. So there's no possible way to... there are protocols within the U.S. government about what to do on first contact, but none of those protocols deal with like something that alien landing on the planet. So, and the reason for that is because there's no way to predict what to do.
All right. I'm going to go into my last one.
Yeah.
But do you have any other points of this that you want to touch on before I go into my last kind of theoretical quandary that we must consider before we make a determination on if the golden record is stupid or not?
No, I've got to say, so far, I'm actually sort of leaning your direction on this one.
Right.
But I do have one point at the end of your last point, but go ahead.
All right, so the next one, and this is in honor of Dr. Frank Drake. I wanted to save this one for the end, and it ties into Stupid Not Stupid Season 1, the season which shall continue forever.
That's right.
Episode 2, Season 1, Episode 2. You know, I don't recommend you go back and listen to it. The audio's rough, and we were just getting our feet under us, but...
It's literally Episode 2.
It's literally Episode 2. But one of the things we talked about in the episode is this theory that kind of Drake developed later in his career, this variable he added to his equation, where he was trying to calculate the number of civilizations that are probably active in the Milky Way galaxy. And he added this concept of what's called the great filter.
Right.
And that's that civilizations advance to a point where they are able to communicate outward, but usually around the time they achieve that level of technological advancement, they destroy themselves and never actually get to the point where they are sustained long enough to be noticed or make contact with other civilizations that are doing the same thing.
Yeah. Physics is physics throughout the universe. And generally, if you've figured out how to transmit radio waves at a pretty high degree of technological capability, you've figured out electrons, which means you've figured out atoms, which means
you have nuclear weapons.
That's right.
Yeah. So I'm going to pose, I guess, a different twist to Drake's great filter. So let's say that Drake was, and I feel bad because the guy just died, so I feel terrible about this. But let's say he was wrong about this concept of the great filter, or that it's not as prevalent as maybe he proposed. I'm going to propose that all that needs to happen is for one civilization, one alien species, to pass the great filter. And the one that passes is the one that is going to become the galactic hegemon.
There can be only one.
There can be only one type 3 civilization. So we see this like with the life forms that we are familiar with here on Earth, right? Like the most aggressive.
By the way, that was a reference to our immortality episode.
not to the movie Highlander. Yeah. That the most aggressive and the most prolific are the things that succeed, right? Like even in terms of like civilizations and cultures going back to our quote-unquote ancient history, right?
Right?
Like the ones that were the most warlike and the most aggressive. There are probably civilizations that we don't even know about, that don't even register on the historical timeline because they weren't aggressive enough. They didn't proliferate enough, right?
Yeah, this has always been my issue with the Saganistic idea that any civilization that was that advanced would be benign or peaceful. Like, that just doesn't fit with
everything we've observed in nature.
With evolution.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So what I'm proposing is the first civilization to pass the great filter without destroying itself will recognize all the other things that we've detailed so far in this episode about why contact with other civilizations is dangerous and have an incentive. Then the second that they're able to communicate, the moment they're detected, that civilization destroys them in order to protect themselves.
Sure.
Right. And so we haven't made contact. There should be lots of signals flying around everywhere. We should be hearing, you know, outreach from every corner of the Milky Way galaxy, at least. And the reason we're not hearing it is because one civilization has made it. And the second you make a peep, it's like whack-a-mole, right?
And they've got a Death Star.
They just got a Death Star and they galactically hammer you, right? And so did we just send out our first peep into the echo chamber, and the galactic hegemon's going to come looking for us. It's just a predator looking for its next snack.
I think I hear the Imperial March now.
Right. and so I guess this is the last kind of, I think I've been clear now. I haven't come out and said it straight away, but I'm pretty clear the side of this I'm on is that the golden record probably wasn't a great idea. It might be kind of stupid. And in honor of, you know, Dr. Drake,
Yes.
And this idea of the great filter, you know, if one civilization at any point in the 14 billion year history, or I'm sorry, the, what are we at, 14.2?
Yeah.
14.2?
Yeah. We'll find out more
with James Webb. Yeah, but in the roughly 14 billion year history of the universe, someone in the Milky Way galaxy has made it past the great filter and is just making sure no one else does. And
right.
did we just sign our own death warrant by sending this thing out?
It's very difficult for me to argue against that. So my final point was that I think that all of this is probably moot. And my reasoning for this is the difficulty in communicating with somebody who has absolutely no commonalities with you whatsoever. And you can't get more extreme than a civilization that came from a different planet. Like, we don't even know if their genetic makeup would be, if genetics are a thing with them. Like, we have no idea what that civilization might look like. And on Earth, we run into this problem, not frequently, but there have been a lot of studies done on this with things like nuclear waste. You know, this is a thing that is going to be deadly to people for much longer than any civilization has
ever lasted.
Yeah,
we've talked about this, the signage, the way to communicate.
Right.
That seemed like an intelligent, well, you can explain what it is, but this is how you should have set up the golden record, right?
Right, right. Yeah. So this was the studies that were done were trying to build something that would last as long as the half-life of this horribly radiological material that would also impart to somebody who had no concept of our civilization, no concept of any language that had ever been spoken that we're aware of, how you could still impart to them this concept of danger of an area. And so, you know, there were these crazy statues that they would build out of like titanium that had like these very pointy, almost cactusy looking things. But we don't know if cactuses or, you know, sharp objects will exist, you know, 100,000 years from now in that, in a capacity that would be recognizable. And that's within the same species over a time period far less than what we're talking about.
Right.
So this idea that the golden record would be at all.
You mean you didn't just take the brainwaves of your girlfriend and put them on a cassette near the nuclear waste? Say, don't do it, guys.
With the footsteps of my children.
Yeah. Oh, that's totally clear. And then you played some like mundane, like 15th century German music over it.
Right. Of course, footsteps of my children would be terrifying. So. But no, so my point is like the idea that even if you have the civilization that's made it through the great filter and they are totally in the business of destroying any civilization that they find, if they found our artifact, the ability to decipher all of the clues that we left.
Like our message was so shitty that we're safe.
Yeah, that there's no chance they're going to be able to follow that map back anyway. So I think we're okay.
Like they're gonna look at it and being like, okay, their god is this dude who just says billions and billions a lot.
Right.
And they don't even like have like a rational way of explaining where they are anymore. They're just going to look at us and be like, oh, that's cute, and just move on.
They're just going to look at that album and go, that's so 1970s. And just like,
let's go abduct that Chuck Berry guy and then just ignore them for the rest of the time.
That's it.
Okay, so our own, the stupidity of the golden record
will be our salvation.
I think you just changed my mind. So the golden record is so stupid that it's not stupid.
That's right.
All right, this is definitely a first. I'm 100% in. I had a 0% chance that you were going to change my mind on this, and you literally just changed my mind. Jesus. Wow. Okay. I mean, I'm with you. The golden record is so stupid that it's not stupid.
That's right.
Okay, well, then I guess you got anything else?
No, that's
on
it
this
for
one?
Me, man.
All right, well,
I win. I'm going to stop on my head, right?
Yeah. All right, well, then if you have any thoughts on this, you know, reach out and shoot us a message, but make sure just go ahead and correlate it and translate it. It has to be directly relatable to the speed of a hydrogen atom going around a hydrogen nucleus. Like, make sure all your points of reference and what you want to explain to us relate to that, and we'll get back to you. All right. Until next time.